You are listening to The Night War, an audio companion. For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. In October 1943, the men of Able Company experienced firsthand why the Italian front would later be considered one of the most brutal battlefields of the entire European theater. Exhausted soldiers fought grueling battles against entrenched German positions, launching ill-fated assaults while ascending skinny mountain roads, often in single file. Knee-deep in mud and drenched in non-stop rain, they faced the indescribable psychological horror of hidden mines and tripwires lying in wait for them. Some units, including Able Company, saw skyrocketing casualty rates, with little ground gained to show for their crushing losses. In these conditions, battlefield commanders sought out every possible advantage that might somehow make a difference against an enemy that had been preparing for the defense of Italy for years. One such commander was the captain of Able Company, who sought out Bucky Barnes for the sharpshooting skill that had already earned him no small measure of notoriety throughout the battalion. When called upon, Bucky did his duty, but not without experiencing a deep moral conflict that would consume him throughout the remainder of his European campaign. In her acclaimed 1992 biography, The Night Warrior, historian Anne Fitzgerald wrote this: "Barnes had tremendous compassion for his enemy, but not for himself. Yet it is that compassion for others which elicits in his reader a profound empathy for Barnes the soldier, and for the circumstances that took hold of the man whose men nicknamed him Nanny Barnes and reforged him into Der Schädeljäger. It reminds us that behind every war, behind every warrior, is a frightened young man simply trying to survive, with something of his soul still intact." We now return to Italy in October of 1943.
But you grow indifferent as the days go by. I'm a little lady, I'm not small fry. There'll be a change in the weather and a change in the sea. From now on there'll be a change in me. My walk will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about I'm gonna change my way of living, and if that ain't enough...
Listen, please. What you are about to hear is true. What you are about to hear is fact, not fiction. Sit right where you are and listen. This is important. It's for you.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents They Live Forever. This is a pledge from the American people to its dead. A pledge from 132 million fighting mad Americans. To those men sleeping in their graves in the Philippines. To those men lying at the bottom of the North Atlantic or in the bay at Pearl Harbor. This is our message. We will not forget. We are not going to make up stories about you. We're going to tell the folks at home what really happened. And they're going to make sure that you live forever.
Killed in action. Sergeant George Gannon, Savannah, Georgia. Gunner's Mate Richard Schuen, Memphis, Tennessee. Private Robert Nichvicki, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Private George Zappala, Roslindale, Massachusetts. Technical Sergeant Herman Reese, Menomee, Michigan.
October 4th. Got a visit from Captain Cooper. He was with Halliwell, who looked real proud. On account of whatever his men do, he gets credit for it, I guess. Anyway, Cooper heard about what me and the fellas did to that battery, and he comes up to me and says, "Son, I hear you're a hell of a shot." Calls me son. What a fucking clown. I know for a fact I got him by a good 2 years. Goddamn West Pointer. Anyway, I don't say much because what does a man say to that? Halliwell jumps in and says, "Sergeant Barnes here took down 5 men from 300 yards, sir. Confirmed." Like that is something to be proud of. I've thought about it a lot. Hell, I haven't been able to stop thinking about it, if I'm honest. Because there's enough fellas in my platoon. Hell, enough fellas in this company who come up and say, "Say, Barnes, where'd you get to be such a crack shot?" Especially Ernie Powell from 3rd Platoon, on account of he's a country boy, and apparently all they do is wander around the woods and shoot at things. At least, that is what I assume, since I cannot understand a single word the bastard says. He is a good shot, anyhow. And I've heard through the fellas that the minute we get out of here, they want us to have a proper contest at it. "Law, Sarge?" If I tell the truth, I will be perfectly happy to never fire a gun again after this war is over. But that is not the kind of thing that plays good when old Sergeant Glenn wants to tell the tale out of salt. I had Gene Benson say to me, not impressed like these other bozos, he says to me, "I don't know how you could do it, Barnes. I know it needed to be done. I'm just saying I couldn't have done it." I think Benson's got the right of it. I killed 5 men from a hidden position. I think most people would call that what a coward does. It doesn't feel like I'm yellow, even though I am afraid all the time. But I don't think being real good at shooting a gun is all that much to be proud of. They didn't know I was there. They didn't even have enough time to figure out what was happening before they and their buddies were down for the count. We went up close to him after to destroy the piece, and I saw exactly where I shot him. All of them with these surprised looks on their face like, I never thought it'd be my mother lost her son. I fired 6 times and got them in the throat, the head, the chest, the head, and the head. 2 on the last one. Makes me feel sick, if I'm honest. But it had to be done, didn't it? It had to be done. That artillery was a meat grinder. Cooper is grinning at me like I'd just been dancing with the prettiest dame in the entire place. And he says, "I've got a mission for you, son. Something real special." "I've got a mission for you, son." "I've got a mission for you." What am I supposed to do but follow him and do what they need me to do? Anyhow, that is the mission. There is an entrenched platoon of Charlie Company pinned down on our right flank, and Cooper and their CO have an idea about using me with some cover to flush out the crowds from one direction and drive them into Charlie, who will quit their current position and flank them. This is all so our boys can get a move on. I don't want to, but it's not like I want anyone else to have to either, is it? October 7th. Ken looked like he was maybe 17. Little hairs on his upper lip that had never been shaved in his life. Got him once in the throat and once in the chest. Mission success is what Cooper called it, and Halliwell thrilled to pieces like he's a crack shot and not me. Wish he were. Another Jerry dead, so what does it matter, except that I'm the reason he's lying there with flies on his face, waiting for us to advance enough that the gravediggers can bury him? It wasn't just him either. There were others, but they at least look older than my goddamn kid brother Jack. Delaney said, I wonder what their names were, and for a second it was like I couldn't breathe, and my heart was beating so fast it was like we'd just run 10 miles. And I heard Rose say, what do you fucking care? You gonna write a condolence letter to Mr. and Mrs. Kraut? Talk to Father Kravinsky. He says that all I'm doing is my duty, that it's killing and not murder in a time of war. He isn't the one pulling the trigger. That kid wasn't gonna kill me. It wasn't self-defense. It was me lining up my shot and pulling the trigger all because some stupid kid made a bad call on where to take a piss, and orders were to get at the Krauts and get him to move. Well, I did that. And when I was gone, Abel got pulled back, so I had time to sleep and eat off the line. But I feel sick as hell. And even though I am tired as I've ever been, I don't think I will sleep. October 9th. So yesterday it was quiet, and so Harry and I split a bottle we drug with us from Sicily. And Harry Miller is nothing if not a goddamn observant son of a bitch. And so he says out of nowhere, "Buck, you know it had to be done." And of course he's talking about the artillery we assaulted, and then the assignment yesterday, which everyone has heard about, and I guess he can see I feel real black about it, even though I haven't said a word to him or anybody. But it is hard when you have a mess of buck privates clapping you on the shoulder happy as hell. It's their Sarge who's a crack shot. Their Sarge who's the talk of the goddamn battalion. And all I really want to do is run to Father Cleary back home right after morning mass like I used to as a kid when I tried to play hooky from school. And he'd take confession and make me say contrition, and then give me a bit of whatever he had around. What I wouldn't give for one of those caramels he carried around in his pockets. It always seemed like those could fix anything. What in God's name would Father Cleary say about all this? And what I'd done? Anyway, after a while, Harry said, "How many of the fellas might have gotten killed if you'd have just ran at the fucking thing?" That's the truth of it, all right. The thing is, I knew I could make those shots back with the artillery. I knew I could, and I knew that it was safer than flanking them like Halliwell suggested. And what was I gonna do? Let Skip take the damn shot when I was right there? Thing is, pal, I told Harry, I didn't hesitate. I just did it. And then yesterday, I thought I wouldn't be able to do it again. But I did. It scares me to hell. It makes me sick to my stomach. Buck, you'll do just about any goddamn thing you can to keep your men alive, Miller said. Like it should have been obvious to me, but it wasn't. Of course you'd do it again. That's why we're non-coms. That's what we're here for. Harry has a way of putting things. Because all of everything else, Father Kavinsky telling me it's not murder in a time of war, and those damn boys excited to hear the story from me directly, none of that does any good at all. But a reminder of why I did it and why I'm here, so that no other mother's poor son has to shoot 5 men or a kid in a Kraut uniform in cold blood, that helps a little in a way saying Hail Mary full of grace doesn't. I don't know if it's good enough for God to forgive me, but if my men are alive and not dead at the end of the day, then perhaps somehow I can live with it. October 11th. Freak accident with mortar tube and Harry squad, and we have 2 dead because if I think a malfunction with mud or something, I don't know. But Ernest Ball and Phyllis Ellis are dead, and this is a real shock to all of us as we've been getting along all right without any KIA for 2 weeks. They are dead for no reason at all, and it happened so suddenly that there was nothing anyone could do. Just according to Chernowitz, their foxhole exploded. I think Chernowitz might need off the line permanently. He has not been the same at all since Frankie Lorenzo, and Ernie and Phil are his fire team. He has been sitting quietly for the last 2 hours, and I have Lipscomb on him to make sure he doesn't lose it completely. But God, do I feel awful for him, and for Harry. No reason for this. No reason for any of this, but they were just doing their damn job, and a piece of shit mortar tube is sending cars to their mothers. And for Phil, his wife and son? He got a letter a month ago his kid was born. I am sick to death of all of this. Men like Phil deserve to go home alive and hold their kid and be there to see him grow up. The saying is, all is fair in love and war. It has to be the biggest fucking bullshit I ever heard. October 13th. Shells and rain for at least the last 18 hours. Radio's not working at all, so we are dug in just trying to return fire, and hoping command hadn't misplaced us on their map for the next strafing run against these goddamn crowd positions. Short on rations, as it has been in possible conditions. It's fucking mud. And we did not get resupplied before this assault. So me, Glenn, and Castellano have been going to each foxhole to take stock of what we have and split the difference as needed. Which means my own foxhole is a mud pit. These little shits better be grateful. Rumor from Gene Benson in 3rd Platoon who ran over with ammo for Rizzo and Delaney that Halliwell is KIA this morning. If so, that is a 3rd officer since Salerno for 2nd Battalion. October 14th. Halliwell wounded, not dead, but very badly indeed. 1st Sergeant Talley made the rounds and was keeping it quiet, but apparently Halliwell's in very bad shape and may not make it. Heard a shell coming and tried to cover Andrews and Fishner from 1st Platoon, but didn't make it. Fitch alive, but evacuated also, and Andrews KIA. What the fuck was Halliwell, that poor bastard, even doing on that side of the line? That had to be 500 yards from 2nd Platoon. October 16th. Relieved by Charlie Company, and not a moment too soon, as I don't think a single able man had slept in days. For all the shells and bullets and grenades and fucking mines, I think we advanced possibly 3 or 4 yards. Visibility poor, terrain poor, weather miserable. Too tired to think. We are all so very tired, and very many casualties, not the least of which is feet that I think may soon fall off. I have not had dry socks in days. Joe Fortunato, WIA from my squad, but will be all right, thank Christ. October 18th. 2nd Platoon has caught a break. 1st Lieutenant Charles Fisher, new CO, straight from Baker, and Miller's friends there. How does he know someone everywhere? Say he is aces, and are very sorry to see him go. Abel is now 30% under strength, and according to Tally, the regiment is in worse shape by comparison, so we are likely to be cycled back on the line shortly. October 21st. Heard the fellas singing. Very strange, given that everything behind and in front of us is downright awful. But sure enough, it was Dunning, Rudy, and Rossi singing a goddamn song Rossi wrote about me. I immediately scrammed and got Harry because this was too good to miss. Anyway, we snuck back to the little show, which was being held in Dunning and Rizzo's tent, along with about 8 or 9 others from me and Harry's squads. Here's how it goes. On the day I shipped out for the war, my mama stood there on the shore, waving her hanky, sobbing quite frankly, my poor little boy, she swore. What'll he do over there without me? What'll he eat, and where will he be? For Ma didn't know about that old pro, Uncle Sam's very favorite draftee. Bucky Barnes is the Brooklyn boy's name, and we all know his great claim to fame. Ain't as many sweethearts, that you can't beat him at darts, but that he worries and nags like a dame. Eat all your rations and drink all your coffee. Go see the doctor, I heard you were coughing. Wear your wool jacket, and your damn self a packet. Nanny Barnes is real calling is bossing. So when you get that good old Sarge Chew out, and you find yourself starting to doubt, know that one thing is true, true through and through, and to God you'll be ready for crowds. It was all me and Harry could do not to laugh, because plainly the fellows were drunk as hell off God knows what, and their singing was not very good, apart from Rossi, who was a fine tenor, if you can believe that. But it has a tune that is not half bad to go along with it. Harry's idea is to do nothing right away, but wait for a good time to get one over on Rossi. Maybe start humming it in a foxhole or something. I have written the words down from memory, and am thinking of improving them, if I can think of some rhymes for Benedetta, or perhaps sending them to Steve, who will surely recognize Nanny Barnes. Hell, he'll probably want to add another 20 verses. October 24th. Mail and rest, but mail first. Finally, a V-mail from Steve. Says absolutely nothing. Hardly a mention of him in Ma's letters either. It's worrying to say the least. Steve never had a problem in his life opening his trap, so I cannot figure how he has nothing to goddamn say in a letter. 4 sentences about praying for me at Mass and all the men doing your duty. Christ, does he lay it on when he feels sorry for himself. Nothing about having enough work or his health or anything. I cannot believe he is still mad at getting left behind, and God knows he has sure held grudges longer than this, but you'd think a guy wouldn't take it out on me. I'm not his goddamn scoliosis, am I? Ma did get Curly, a tree grows in Brooklyn, like I asked for her birthday from me. I think she was really delighted to know that I've read it about 3 times over since it came out with all the other pocketbooks last month. She wrote her letter in her meticulous, sweet way. I will transcribe the whole thing here, because her letter is now in my breast pocket, and may well get ruined, but I feel somehow safer for having it on me.
Though I am, of course, so very proud you are doing your part in fighting the Nazis, you do know how badly I wish you were here and not there. I miss you so. All of Brooklyn seems smaller and duller and emptier when it does not have my big brother in it. And I know you will hate hearing it, but I cried and cried reading the book you gave me for my birthday, and imagining it was you reading aloud to me like you did when I was little. And I went to Williamsburg and looked for her tree myself and imagined myself as Francie, until realizing it's not me who is Francie, but you. My sweet big brother who always tells me stories, and cares for me, and does anything to help. Then I found somehow that I could miss you more, even when I thought I already missed you as much as anyone could miss a person. Thank you for my birthday present. For Christmas, please send yourself. So much love and kisses from your adoring sister, Curly.
So very tired. I cannot believe it has been 7 months since home. Somehow these 7 months have felt as long as 7 years. How many more of her birthdays will I miss, I wonder? October 31st. Thinking of Halloween in 37, the year before Mrs. Rogers died, and all Curly wanted was to go to the contest at Central Park because she saw the advertisement in the paper. She was determined to be a nurse, and Mrs. Rogers heard about it, of course, and so on Halloween day at lunch she brought a costume for Curly that she'd made herself by taking in her own uniform so it would fit, and she brought instruments home from the ward. It was a surprise for Curly when we all got home from Mass, and I remember she just started bawling, she was so surprised and joyful. Steve and me took her and Teddy and Jack to the contest, and she did not come even close to winning, but that was the happiest little girl in all of Manhattan regardless. There was a photo booth, and I paid for 2 pictures, and Curly wanted them both with Steve. Naturally, she is 13 now, but I'm sure she still plans on marrying him, even if she won't crow about it like she used to. In one picture, she pretended to be treating him for his asthma. I am a nurse, Steve. And in the other, he was kissing her hand like she was Snow White or something. That's the one Mrs. Rogers put up over her kitchen sink. It was the last thing Steve took down from the old place. Come to think of it, that was Mrs. Rogers' last real Halloween, as the last one she was in the hospital. What a wonderful lady she was. Anyhow, it is Halloween here. No monsters other than krauts and shells, and plenty of them. I like to think Mrs. Rogers has kept me safe so far, and if she can just hold on for a while longer, maybe I will see Curly again.
In 1947, when Rebecca Barnes found the first of Bucky's 14 field journals in his footlocker, she found that several pages had been torn out. Later, she discovered those missing pages buried inside a bundle of Bucky's many unsent letters. Sometime in early November of 1943, he'd hidden them in one of his boots, hoping that his words might somehow find their way home, even if he did not.
Undated. This is a letter to my family, and I'll keep this on my body as long as I can. I am Sergeant James Barnes of Company A, 2nd Battalion, 107th Infantry Regiment, 36th Infantry Division, 6th Corps, U.S. 5th Army, serial number 32557038. Out of Brooklyn, my folks are George and Winnie Barnes, and my brothers are Theodore and John, and my sister is Rebecca. To Ma, should have wrote more, Ma, I'm sorry. I love you, and I'm proud to be your son. You too, Pop, and I hope I did you proud. You and Ma and the boys, too. I tried my best, Dad, I swear I did. Please tell Steve for me I'm sending all the stupid back his way, and that it'll be hard, but if he could try not to get his face beat in so much, he'd be doing everybody a big favor. Me especially, since I can't be there to dazzle the dames for him no more. Sorry, pal. Did my best to get back, but it all got fucked up. All my earthly possessions, please, to Rebecca. You're the best of us, Curly. The best and sweetest sister a man could ask for. I won't make it for Christmas, but you have all my books, and I am so sorry, but that is the best I can do. If you don't go to school, I'll haunt you. Everything of mine to Curly, but my glove to Jack, please. And Jack, if you don't make the Dodgers after all this is over, it's a damn shame. Don't fall for the damn slider, pal. And Teddy, it's on you now. Your job is to be the big man. Take care of him like I know you will. I wouldn't trust anyone more. Sorry, sorry, love and love and love, Bucky. Please, to who finds my body, return this letter to my family.
When you have found my body, please send this letter to my family. Excuse my bad German.